Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest episode of Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Ashley Adrain, and we are going to be talking about her domestic thriller, The Whispers. Okay, this is a Book Reporter Bets On selection, just like her first book, The Push. I joke that after reading her first book, I never look at little pink mittens quite the same way. Somebody shows me little pink mittens, I'm like, whoa, what's going on behind those? After reading The Whispers, I will ensure that all windows in children's bedrooms have screens and that they lock, okay? I'm going there. And I'm going to be very careful who I share my house keys with, because you just never know, folks. So our reviewer, Ray Palin, had this to say about The Whispers. It's an eye-opening and tightly wound thriller involving characters so real that they could exist in your own neighborhood. I so agree. I've been watching the neighbors out the window because, you know, you just see people walk by. What do I know and not know about that? And with that, welcome, Ashley. So good to see you again.
Oh, Carol, thank you for having me back. I love chatting with you for The Push. And so I'm excited to be here for The Whispers. Thank you.
So much fun. So how about if you give us the elevator pitch, a quick overview for The Whispers, so that I don't have to do it and screw it up.
Sure. Yes. You'd probably do a better job than I would, though. So the Whispers is about four neighboring women who live on Harlow Street, and they don't quite realize the ways in which their lives are connected until there's a tragedy that happens on the street one night. And that event sort of acts as this thread that's pulled that sort of unravels all of their lives as they sort of make connections between, you know, each other and each other's families. And they're each sort of forced to face the whispers that they've long ignored in their own lives.
Ooh, the whispers. And oh boy, there are so many. Well, there's a scene that opens the book that is sort of sets the stage on Harlow Street, this fabulous end of summer party. So let's start with that, because it really sets the stage for what's going to go from there.
Yeah, so that's right. Yes, there's an end of summer party. So it's sort of the kids are going back to school and it's just sort of past Labor Day. And there's a character in the book. There's four main characters in the book that we get a perspective from. And Whitney is one of these women. And she is the character who is, she's a little bit larger than life. She's extremely confident. She's has, you know, three children, and yet she really is not very into being a mother. She is very into her career. She's very into sort of work and everything else that she has going on. Which I think we can all relate to. We know someone like this. She is the person who has like the nicest house on the street. You know, she's the house that stands out on the sort of gentrifying street in the neighborhood. And so she has everyone over to her backyard, and she's sort of hosting this very, you know, beautiful Instagram worthy party with, you know, the perfect appetizers. And she's wearing this beautiful silk dress and everything's going, you know, extremely well. And she's very pleased with herself and she's had a few drinks. And everyone's kind of watching her and sort of whispering about, you know, how nice the party is. And then she needs to find her son. She's like missing her 9-year-old son, who she can't find him anywhere. And she searches the house for him and she's getting annoyed. And he's the kind of kid who could really just like push her buttons in an instant, you know, really just trigger something in her all the time. And she's watching all the other kids in the neighborhood be very lovely and, you know, kind to each other and well-dressed. And she's just sort of seething, trying to find him. And she goes up to the third floor where his bedroom is, and she opens the door and she finds him in his bed, eating all of the cookies that have each of the child's name on them, the party favors that she's carefully made for everyone at the party. And she just, it turns her into really a fit of rage, and she screams at him very terribly and swears at him and just completely loses it in this burst of anger. And then she realizes that his bedroom window is wide open and everybody below at the backyard party has gone dead silent. And they have all heard her completely lose it and scream at her son and heard the awful things she said. And that acts as the opening scene. And that acts as this, you know, catalyst for what will then happen for the rest of the book. There's a line at the end of that chapter that says, you know, in that moment, Whitney realizes exactly what she has lost. And that's sort of at the heart of the book, you know, this mm-hmm. idea of the sort of shame as a mother and the judgment she then realizes she will have to work so hard, you know, to overcome. And she doesn't quite know if she has that in her to do. That scene really sets off a lot in the book. And as we go through the present day, which is 9 months later, we flash back to that, to scenes from that backyard party. And we sort of head hop from each person at the party, each of the main characters, to kind of get a perspective on what they think about the party and what they think of each other. And that sort of weaves in with some of the present day stuff too. So it became a very sort of important element of the story in the end.
It is so great because you just picture this woman being totally humiliated and then walking downstairs and going, I'll have another cocktail.
Like, yes, just having to go back to the party.
Am I going to ignore it? Like, no one heard, really. And everyone's kind of looking at her differently after that, yeah, because they thought she was so perfect before. And now she's like, not. Was that the scene that sort of set off the book? Like, did you always know that was the opener?
It's interesting. No, that kind of came to me a little bit later. So the real thing that set off, it was more about character and the relationships between the characters that sort of sparked something for me. So I live at the time that I had the idea for the book and then was writing the book, I lived on a street here in Toronto. I'm in Toronto, Canada, and I lived in Little Portugal. And that became sort of the setting for this book, this idea. We lived on this street that was like, you know, had been kind of gentrified. And it was sort of this collection, like a kind of a random collection of people lived on this street. There was, you know, families like mine that were kind of moving in and renovating houses and fixing things up and, starting families and all of that. And then there were these really wonderful sort of older families and older couples that were Portuguese immigrants, you know, who had lived in those houses for 60, 70 years sometimes, you know, and they had raised their families in these houses and they were untouched, you know, from those times. And so it was, and we had a neighbor actually who, they were a couple who embodied this really beautiful porch culture, you know, where they were in their 80s and they would sit on their porch all day long, you know, together. Oh. And they would just kind of watch the world go by and watch the street go by and watch us come and go with our kids. And I always used to think, they never spoke English and I don't speak Portuguese. So in the 8 years that we lived there, we never actually had a conversation. But of course, there's so much communication that happens back and forth, especially with neighbors, you know, just verbal cues and smiles and waves and all of that. And I always used to think, wow, I wonder what that mother thinks of me. You know, I wonder what she thinks of all of these new moms on the street having their kids for the first time. And, you know, just living such a different life, you know, than what she would have lived at that time on that street. And it, you know, it became this, you know, as I said, more kind of gentrified area, but it used to be sort of a very poor, difficult, hard neighborhood of a very poor, hard street. I always used to think about like how that came across to her. And that really became sort of this thing I wanted to, a dynamic that I really wanted to write about in the book. And so that sort of turned into the character of kind of, you know, we've got these three women in their 40s, you know, early 40s, and then Mara, who is 80 or the 80-year-old character in the book. So there was that set it off. But then the other thing that set off the idea for the book that I sort of followed was, and you mentioned it in your great opening, is the window and what happens later. So that window is pivotal because, of course, as I just said, it is open. And then we hear, you know, everybody in the party hears Whitney lose it. But the other key thing about that is another sort of the second inciting incident in the book, which is that I won't spoil anything by mentioning this because it happened so early, but that same child later, you know, in the year falls out of his bedroom window and ends up in the ICU. And so that same house that I'm describing on the street that we lived in had a third floor, it was actually a second floor. And my son's bedroom, when we first moved into the house, he was a newborn when we first moved into the house, but there was a window that opened to the front of the street, and it didn't have a screen and it didn't have a lock. And it was one of those like old windows that was really low to the ground, you know, like a tall. Yes. And so the people that lived there before us, I guess, like, you know, just the window could just open onto the street and it was not a problem. But of course, that was our child bedroom when we moved in. And, you know, I didn't have to worry about it because he was just a baby at the time in a crib. But I thought every single day about what would happen if the window opened and this child fell out into the backyard or onto the street. It was something that crossed, you know, those little things kind of cross your mind every day.
Yeah.
So that really made its way into that was like this, you know, the spark of the idea as well of what would happen if. So there was lots of kind of little things sort of that you know that grew into what the book was. But that backyard party, it came a little bit later once I needed something to kind of
get them all together.
Yeah, get them all together and show the dynamics between them all in one place and one time. Exactly. Yeah.
And I also love that Whitney's last name is Loverly. And I love that it's like, she's so loverly. She's so like loverly on so many different levels. And I was just, and you know, we all know a Whitney. We all know somebody that it all looks really good. But if you go inside, it's so fractured inside. Mm-hmm. It's so, and it's sometimes when you get to know people, you know them very top line. Mm-hmm. And then when you get in deeper, and I think that you're hitting on something too, is that there are a lot of women in their 40s. And I always say the 40s is when you get honest. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
In your 20s and 30s, you have the best boyfriend, the best husband, the best house, the best kids, the best whatever. And you're in your 40s and all of a sudden, you know, this is really driving me crazy. And this is really not working for me. And you can say it because you can kind of own it at that point. Whereas before, you're kind of making yourself. And by the time you're that age, you're kind of made. So you can sit there and say, this isn't working for me. Whereas before, to admit something wasn't working for you would mean it was on you. The other way you can push out. Is that like a crazy thing to say? But
I think that's so brilliant. You know, I've been talking a lot about these decades of life and midlife and 40s, and I've never heard anyone articulate it like that. But I think that's so brilliant. The idea that in your 40s, you can get honest. You are so right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really true. And the way I've been thinking about it and sort of writing this book is, and I'm 41, so I'm like, starting in that decade, but I love that because I think the 20s is like this very selfish decade, right? As it should be. It's like, you're trying to figure out who you are. You're making decisions that are just good for you. You're trying to get yourself to where you want to go. You're still so full of hopes and dreams. You know, it's like, this is a wonderful decade of life. And then in your 30s, you're like making decisions. You're all the choices are happening. It's all the doing. And when you're starting a family and choosing a city to live in and establishing a career and deciding whether or not to have kids and probably having your first kid and all of that, you know, you're right. There's no time to be honest. There's no space to be honest, right? Yeah. You are trying to create this image for the world and for yourself and for the people you love of like, this is, you know, I've arrived. This is who I am. This is how great my life looks. And you're trying to convince yourself of that the whole time too, right?
It's all great.
Yeah. But then you're right. When I think about the 40s, I think about like, all of that chaos has stopped.
Right.
You know, the decisions are made. You are who you are. You have the life you have. There's not that much opportunity to like start again or do something new, or, you know, you're sort of living with all of your choices for the first time. And so you're right. What you've pinpointed is the honesty. That is, I think you're right, where it happened. So I think it's like a fascinating time in life. I really do. Mm-hmm. I love writing about it. And I just think it's just so deep and so rich with so much hard emotion, you know, and hard truth. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, and you know, like for Whitney at this point, admitting that there's something going on with her son, admitting that this is going on. She doesn't want to because she is still in that perfect land. She's still stuck back there. But everybody else would have sat there and said, oh, what are we going to do? How can we fix this? What can we do? But she's just there like, you're not up to my standards. Yeah. And it's almost like I could dismiss you like right now because you're not making the cut with me. And it's so interesting when you see something like that happen. And it's also like even with your house. You get to the point where if you haven't dusted and the company comes over, you really don't care. Like it's really okay. But before you feel like you're putting on a show.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, okay, the show might not have a performance tonight. The show might just be like on the cut, off the cuff, you know?
This is gonna happen. No, you're absolutely right.
Four women are so different. We've definitely covered what Whitney's like. I mean, she's just like high powered, you know, not super lovely. But then we've got these other women. We've got Mara, who's older. But then we've got Blair. And Blair doesn't know really who she is yet. But she wants to be somebody else. But she doesn't really want to.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. I feel like now that the book's been out for a little bit and I've been chatting with readers, like I think Blair is probably the person that people relate to the most, you know, just in terms of, I mean, she's at a tricky part in life that I think like almost all of us, no matter what, can relate to in some way. And that, again, she sort of just hit this, you know, stage of being 40 and, you know, her child's a little bit older now. Like she has one daughter who's really kind of like, you know, she's at that kind of age of 7 when they just seem so much bigger and, you know, they seem like you can almost just see that they're going to like rush into teenagehood and be gone so soon, you know? And she's starting to think like, okay, what, how did I get here? Like, how did I get to this life where I gave up my career when she was born to stay home? I'm in this marriage that doesn't feel good. And I can't quite put my finger on why. I'm not happy. And I can't quite put my finger on why. And if I, you know, pay too much attention to what's wrong in my life, the consequences are going to be too great. And so it is easier to just keep marching along. You know, she talks about how it's easier for her family and it's easier for her and everyone around her if she just sucks it up and just keeps on going day by day, you know, and doesn't dissect, doesn't ask questions, doesn't kind of pull things apart. And I think a lot of women can relate to that on some level, you know, maybe not as extreme as Blair, but on some level, I think all of us at some point have been like, oh, this one thing's not working, but ugh, I can't deal. I just can't deal with it. I can't deal with what that means. So I'm sticking to the plan. Right.
Right.
And I think for women, especially, that is such, that is sort of becomes the status quo. And you sort of look around you at the other women and you just kind of want to keep up and keep going. And you don't want to be the person like because I'm at this age, you know, I have friends now who just now are like marriages are starting to break up and people are starting to separate. And, you know, I can really see, especially like, you know, post pandemic and everything. And I can, and it's like, you can see how hard it is for the first people, you know, to like, to be the first people in a social group or, you know, a social life, to have to like say that and make that decision and do that. And Blair's sort of on the cusp of that, right? Like she's thinking, okay, like I do think there's something wrong with my marriage. She does suspect her husband's having an affair, and probably wasn't always the perfect person for her anyway. But how do you confront that? And you know, I think what's fun about what was really fun about writing Blair and Whitney as best friends, you know, they live across the street from each other, but they sort of act as foils to one another. You know, they are the opposite women in so many ways. Blair does love, you know, being maternal, and she feels quite maternal, and she really, you know, loves her daughter deeply, in a way that Whitney can't quite find, you know, and yet Whitney has this whole life outside of her family, and Blair craves that, but she has no idea how to get it. And so they, you know, frustrate one another, they envy one another, they love one another, they really get something out of each other's relationship, but there's definitely some power imbalances happening there. And I think that's probably true of a lot of friendships, you know, that power imbalance.
I also think that Blair comforts herself by saying, but I make the cookies after school, but I'm here. If she forgets her book bag, I'm here. I take her to school. I walk this. Everybody else is not doing that. And I think that there is, as much as freedom comes, there is judgment. And I think the judgment gets a lot like higher or bigger as time goes on of, well, look what she did. Look at how her child's behaving. Look at this. I was there all the time. So that didn't end up happening. So I think it's just like really interesting. And there's also Blair's obsession with Whitney. And it takes on this really creepy tone, this one scene where she's in Whitney's house. And I gotta tell you, that was like a, whoa, what's going on here?
I know.
And that's why I think like, who's got keys? Like who's got keys and what's going to happen? So that's her too, because she wants to, she so covets to be. And when you get to that scene, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about. And it's like, okay, Blair.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. She really goes for it. And I think there's that, that obsessive quality, you know, that obsessive quality about each other, but mostly, you know, Blair towards Whitney, there's this real obsession with, wanting to be close to Whitney, wanting to be closer to her life, wanting to see what it feels like to be her. And I really loved the idea of Whitney, or of Blair, you know, snooping through Whitney's house, because it's so cringy. Like it's just such a thing that you would never do, but you might want to do, but you never would. And it's such an invasion, you know, it is such an invasion of Whitney's life. And yeah, I just thought like it was such a juicy, fun thing to write about.
Yeah. One time we had an open house here at the house, like, but people really thought it was open house, and they're like wandering around the house going, it was so nice for you to open your house to us. And I was like, I wasn't thinking of doing the whole house. You know what I mean? Yeah. I started thinking the first floor, and then all of a sudden you've kind of disappeared. So it, yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah.
And then we got Rebecca, who's this ER doctor. She longs for a child. And that influences how she looks at the neighborhood, because she sees these mothers who she's seeing have fulfillment with a child. She's seeing that that's an act of fulfillment. And for not having a child, she feels like she's lacking. So Rebecca, meanwhile, is at the hospital. Like she does all these things to help people. But back here, she's really feeling like she hasn't made the mark. She's failed. Is that like a good assessment of her?
I think so. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Rebecca is... you know, I think she sort of ends up being everyone's sort of favorite character in a way, you know, she's, you know, like I have such a problem with the terms like unlikable, you know, characters or likable characters, but people do call her, you know, the most likable character. And I get that. She is, a woman who, you know, she lives amongst, you know, she's the fourth neighbor, and she lives amongst these women who you know, have these full family lives, you know, or appear to have these very full family lives. And yeah, she and her partner are struggling with reoccurring miscarriage. And so they are able, very, you know, easily able to get pregnant, but the pregnancy does not stick. And of course, you know, if anyone has been through something like that or had miscarriages or been through, you know, fertility challenges like that, I think, you know, one of the most frustrating things about it is that there usually are so few answers. You know, they're usually so often a doctor, you know, will have to sit across from you, not that they want to, but they have no choice, you know, to sit across from you and say, just keep trying, you know, just keep trying. We don't have an answer. We don't have a reason. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. You know, that is a horribly underfunded area of science and medicine. But that is so frustrating. And I was thinking about how frustrating that would be for somebody who was a doctor, you know, who was medically minded, whose every decision every day, you know, working at an ER department in a children's hospital was based on fact and science and, you know, like the answers of how to get to, you know, from point A to point B. And yet she's struggling with this very personal health problem that has no answer. And so I was sort of interested in that, in that dichotomy of how that would feel for her. There's this notion, I think, when you have fertility problems around hope, you know, this idea of hope. And it can be such a beautiful thing and such a horribly frustrating thing. And I wanted sort of Rebecca to have to grapple with that idea of hope. And, you know, she's got these families who are bringing in very sick children, and hope is a part of that vernacular too, right? And so I wanted to sort of just like experiment with that a bit in terms of how that would feel for Rebecca and her husband and, you know, her interactions at the hospital, but also her interactions with, you know, these friends of hers and neighbors of hers. Cause she obviously ends up playing this, as you said, this very strong caregiver role, you know, for everybody, for the son and for Whitney and everyone else involved. So she was interesting. She was an interesting character to be in the dynamic of these women. I really enjoyed writing about her. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's measuring herself against everybody else. She's trying because she hasn't achieved that one thing that she really feels is, nirvana for her, is having a child. She thinks that having the child is going to make everything work and everything's going to come to be and blah, blah, blah. And it was interesting too, because these people were not super honest with their husbands. They weren't. And I think that so much of your life when you're in your 40s is also you're taken away from, because you're worrying about your children. Yeah. And that's the first thing you worry about. And you don't worry about your marriage in quite the same way. You're worrying about your children being happy, fed, comfortable, good in school, showing up at school. I mean, during the pandemic, when you were writing this book, it was like, basically, let's not get on each other's nerves tonight. Let's just do something. And there were no ways of outlet and things like that. And I think that that's the other thing that happens in 40s is, you're so consumed with children, it's hard to think about marriage. And I think that each of these women are thinking about their marriage, but sort of like back here, because it was choice of marriage or kids, they're going for kids.
Oh, that's such a good observation. That is another great observation about the 40s. You're right. You're absolutely right.
Because it's also, it's like, well, I have to take care of these other people who need me. And you don't see yourself as being needed in the marriage, like quite the same way, because like, well, you can feed yourself. You can fend for yourself. You can And it's just so difficult.
I think most people in that decade for sure are putting marriage second. Definitely. And I think a lot of that, like again, with a lot of these characters, like they don't really want to confront any issues in their marriage. Because again, like the consequences are too great. Like, you know, the consequences of like breaking up a family in your 40s and your kids around that age are really, really hard. Like that is a very difficult decision that comes with a lot of baggage and a lot of like tough things. And I think especially something I sort of touch on with Blair, but I think is, you know, probably we don't read a lot about it in books, I think, but it is very much a part of reality. It's just financial, like the role that finances and economics play for a lot of women. Like there was, I was writing something for the UK, for my publisher in the UK, sort of about this topic. And so I'm sort of more familiar with the stats there, but there are like, the stats are overwhelming that women will at that age, like stay in a relationship or stay in a marriage just because they don't feel like they can afford to be, to break up. And we do see a bit of that from Blair, right? We see a bit of her kind of thinking like, okay, but where am I going to live? Like, are we going to be able to keep the house? And I don't think we can keep the house. So then where am I going to live and where is he going to live? And there's one scene that I thought was, you know, it was a little tangential, but I thought it was so important to include, where she's looking back on this time where she actually goes to see a condo, you know, she goes to see a condo that's for rent. And she's just, and it's such a bold, crazy, hard thing for her to do. You know, she says she's going to the grocery store. She goes to meet with a realtor And she just wants to see what it feels like to be standing in the kind of apartment that she could afford to rent if she were to get separated. Right. And she's following the realtor and she's kind of looking around and she's looking at the bathroom and she's looking at the bedroom and she's thinking about where her daughter could be. And she's realizing that like furniture won't fit and, you know, all, and she's trying to just fantasize about like, God, could I really do this? You know, right. This is all I can afford. Can I really do this? And I think that's very real for a lot of people, you know, that's really hard, really, really hard. And I think that affects a lot of women and it's hard. I think a really hard thing to talk about.
Yeah. And I think it's like, could my life fit here? It's not just could I live here, could my life fit in this apartment when I go look at this? In our town, a lot of people get divorced when the kids got out of college, went to college, one or the other. That's usually the big benchmark time.
Yeah.
And they had enough money, they split the money, and they went on their own. A couple of years ago, probably more like a few years ago now, like the pandemic was like a year, but it was three. But you know, it was like in the 3 years of like whatever. But I was in yoga class one night and somebody says, are you still married? And I'm like, do you know something that I shouldn't know or something? Just, no, everybody else is divorced. Can we go out to dinner? And I just sat there and I had this look on my face of like, yeah, you're right. So many people. And now we're at the age where everybody's downsizing and leaving. And that would take me about 5 years. Yeah. And I'd have to establish the Carol Fitzgerald Library to get rid of all the books, you know, and we're so not ready. And everybody's like, well, don't you just want to have, and I'm like, not really, but it's this next phase. It's like, and people are in these phases of life, but you're right. At this point, swimming can't think about it. They've just got to think about like holding on by your fingernails and making the best of it because they don't have a choice. You know?
Yeah. Exactly.
And we also see the homes that are new and the homes that have been there forever. And it's a lot about the haves and the have nots. Mm-hmm. It's, will you be able to make that addition? Will you be able to do this? And unless you get like this tough exterior of we're happy, like we're not going to change, it's really okay. Everybody seems to feel like they've got to climb like this as well and do things. And we joke here, we have the 1970s kitchen if they ever need it. And we cook a lot. And they say like, well, why don't you like do the kitchen? And I'm like, I don't even know what I want to do in the kitchen. Like, I cannot think. No. We're both running companies right now. We have no time to do the kitchen and decide. But it's funny because people will come in and they're like, but you love to cook. And I'm like, yeah, but the oven works. Like, it's really
we're fine. We're good. Yeah.
We're really okay right now. It's the last thing I would need to worry about. That's a year. You know. And I think that when you look at the neighborhood here, you're seeing everybody's judging you by your house as well.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Whitney's got the greatest house. She's got the best, but she still doesn't have a screen on that window.
She still doesn't. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I had fun writing about the houses and sort of imagining what they were each like. And, you know, they each are quite distinct. All four houses that we see are very distinct. And I sort of mentioned that this idea of these neighbors that we had who their house was, you know, had not been touched, you know, in decades and decades and decades, and everything around them was sort of being taken over. And there was just such a stark contrast, you know, between the way that they lived in this house and what I imagined kind of going on sort of behind that front door. And also this sort of sadness, like this idea that like they were happy and lovely and lived in this, that was a wonderful thing. But the sadness came from the fact that you knew that within the next 5 to 10 years, they're going to have to sell that house. You know, they won't be able to live there anymore. And then what will become of that house, you know, and what becomes of this place that has, you know, maintained this total sense of history, you know, and that like just saddens me. And also the idea of their porch, like they just loved their porch so much. And nobody who was renovating and building these new houses was keeping a porch. Like they were, you know, they were completely changing, you know, the whole look of the house as people do. But that porch is so significant, you know, to that culture that had immigrated there. And that was their way of communicating. And that was a social space, you know? And so there was things like that I thought a lot about living in that neighborhood. And then, you know, Rebecca and her husband buy this house, which I think is also like a really common thing. You know, they haven't started their family yet. They're looking for their first home. They think it'll be no problem. And they're going to have two or three kids to come. And so they buy a house that, you know, from a builder that has been renovated to sell. And it is a house that is specifically built for a family, you know, and you can kind of tell there's some details in the house about, there's like a banquette in the kitchen and there's sort of, you know, wipeable fabric on the banquette and there's hooks that are a little bit lower, you know, for kids to reach and all these details that a builder would put into a home to try to entice, you know, a couple that wanted to raise their family there. And so they buy this house thinking they're going to fill this house with children. And of course, then they can't. Wow. And so what does that house do to them? You know, how does it feel every time you see those hooks that are lower? And how does it feel every time you're on the kid-friendly bench? And so the houses became such a there was such a tie, I think, to these four houses, to like the emotional state, you know, of each of these people. So I really loved writing about that. And I'm always, I'm always interested in people's homes and the way they live there and what they choose to do. And I'm definitely that person who, which I feel like a lot of people are, but you know, when you go for a walk in the evening and it's dark out and people's lights are on and their curtains are a little bit open and you sort of just want to say, oh, what's going on in there? You know, what does that look like? What is, you know? So there's a bit of that. There's a bit of that in the book, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also like when we were growing up, we had one aunt and she had two kitchens. She had an upstairs kitchen and a downstairs kitchen, like a big Italian thing to do. But we drove by the house and we thought that house was so big. And then you drive by and it's not what you thought it was. Like they're just like these misconceptions. And I'm thinking of Mara, who's seen it all through the years. What do you think about these women who just want more, 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 more? I need more, more, more. And what does she really want? She's the sort of person no one sees. Yeah. And you saw the people that were on the porch, but I'm sure these people, well, we won't really have them at the party because she wouldn't really like to come. So so this whole thing could be happening. She's looking over the fence, but she's not that important. Why is she not important? And nobody says this, you know, some people just don't even think about her. They just, she doesn't have this kind of a feeling to anybody. Yeah.
Glanced over, right? Yeah, it's interesting. That's like she, I thought it was just so important that she be this, like she's very much a voyeur, you know, she is the voyeur of the street. And you can be a voyeur when you are invisible, you know, when you feel invisible and people do just glaze over you, you know, in the rest of the neighborhood. And we've been talking about this these backyard party scenes. And she is not invited. Well, she is invited to the party. Technically, she gets the invite, but she knows she's not really invited to the party. You know, she knows she is not quite welcome there. Nobody follows up with her. Nobody says, are you coming? And so she's just next door, you know, on the other side of the fence. And she's sort of in her backyard kind of listening to this, you know, party happen. And she can recognize the voices and overhear the conversation. And so we get the perspective that she's just sort of, she knows that she is not quite welcome there. And that's this real sort of, I think we all can have a lot of empathy for that, you know, of this, of feeling that way. And she's also just at this time in life when like, yeah, she, I think like she just is very much not considered to be important, you know, by these other women on the street. And of course the tragedy in that, and also like the irony of that is that while all these women are dealing with, you know, these big issues of motherhood and marriage and life and feeling like their worlds are, you know, is she really the person with the most wisdom in this group of women is Mara. You know, she has the wisdom they are all seeking. She has the wisdom of a life lived, of a difficult, very difficult life lived, you know, as an immigrant family coming to the street, you know, raising her son who has a lot of differences and challenges, with a husband who is, you know, not kind, not a kind man, not an easy man to live with. And we sort of see Mara's backstory, you know, with her son and her husband. And that is the sad irony of it is, you know, they are all seeking these answers to decisions and seeking wisdom in their life. And Mara is right there next door with all of it, you know, who could understand so much more than they would ever assume that she would. But nobody asks her, you know, no one asks her for that. No one cares enough to find out her story. No one cares enough to invite her over, you know, for the glass of wine to kind of hear about what her life is like. And there's something so sad, you know, sort of sad about that, but that's sort of true to life. You know, I think that's sort of true to how generations kind of treat each other, you know.
It's differently different. Oh, you're not going to understand. You're not going to understand. You're not going to
understand. She won't, you know, she'll judge us. She's not going to. And of course there is judgment there. Like it's hard not to judge. And Mara does judge them. But she also understands so much more about where they're at in life than they would ever imagine. Yeah.
I feel like, I felt like that about her. I also feel there's something big that happens. Well, there's something big that happened in her past, but there's something big that happens the day that something big happens on the street. And I'm being very ambiguous here. And nobody seems to notice that this big thing happened to her because everybody is so concerned with what happened to Xavier. Everybody's concerned about that, but they totally miss that there's been this whole big change in her life and nobody's kind of on it. And she's got a relationship later on that we see, and we don't see at the beginning, but we see it later and we see how important that is. And I'm being vague here because I don't want to give anything away because it was a treasure when I saw it. It was like this little Easter egg when I saw it, because you could see how it was going to happen, but you weren't really thinking about it. And you did a good build up to that, you know?
Thank you. Thanks, Carol. That's so nice to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, it was so good. Mm-hmm. So what happened to him is the whole backdrop of the book. Did you know that like from the start, like, okay, you know, he's out the window. I'm like, okay. And then we'll figure out how he got there and why he got there and all those kinds of things.
Yeah. I really didn't plot out very much with this book at all. It was real. There was, I had a lot of like open-ended questions, a lot of things that I didn't quite know the answer to, but was writing anyway. I was just writing through it anyway. And I did end up changing things. Like there were some different endings along the way that I was sort of thinking through and trying to make work, but they weren't quite working.
Yeah.
And my editors were so great about like just the feedback and sort of helping me kind of get to the place where the book needed to go. And I think I always kind of write like that. Like I always sort of write where I don't really know where things are going. And because I really do believe that like, if you're surprised as the writer about where things can go, then the reader's going to be surprised too, you know, but right. I always think the original idea that I usually have for the ending is probably too predictable, you know, and then readers would probably feel that way. So both times in both of my books, it has changed, as I've gone, but yeah, I roughly knew why it happened. I knew what it had to be connected to, but I didn't know exactly how. And then, yeah, that came later through revisions. Yeah.
It's like, wow. But, you know, it also makes me think that she should have something down on her kitchen table of get screen, like, you know,
yeah.
faster for the screen. It should have been, like, look, if they do a movie, it's got to be that somebody's got written on a piece of paper, fixed screen.
Yeah, on a to-do list.
Screened window, closed window, you know, something like that. Yeah.
I agree.
So, you know, it's funny because in The Push and The Whispers, you write about challenging children.
Mm-hmm.
And when everyone has a child, they think the child is going to be fine. Everything will happen. And they will sit quietly in a restaurant while we eat dinner. And also in school, there will be no challenges. Everything will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
You've written about a challenging child in both of your books. And I think it gets people out of their comfort zone of everything is fine with like having a child. Is that what you're doing there? Because it's like, perfect folks, you know?
Yes. It's so interesting. It hasn't been such a conscious choice, to be honest, but it definitely is there. And I, you know what I think where that comes from, to be honest, is, and actually I should say like, I actually don't have very challenging children. I've got children that are like very manageable. But I think that where that comes from is so when I had my first, I went into motherhood with a lot of trepidation. Like I was not sure this was going to be for me. I was very nervous about it. I wasn't like a kid person, you know, who like loved to babysit or could connect with kids easily. So I was nervous about motherhood. And as it happened, so we had my son, he's 8 years old now, but we had him 8 years ago and everything was okay for the first couple of weeks. And then he got very, very, very ill, and ended up in the hospital. And he, you know, we were in the hospital for months and he ended up being diagnosed with a chronic health condition, which we've been, you know, dealing with substantially, you know, his whole life and will continue to. And so, you know, I think that experience of just the idea that you think motherhood's going to go some way, you think your kids are going to, you have this idea. I think when you enter motherhood, you know, you have this idea of who you think your kids are going to be. And we all to get through it, it's just human nature. We all think that we're going to have all of this control over them and they're going to be these people that we mold them into, you know, into be. And we think there's a lot of predictability there. And we have this idea that we're going to create these, you know, a certain type of child. And we just don't. Like, that's just not how it works. And I think that for so many people, their children end up just being just totally different people in the world than what they thought, you know? And in a very different way, that was sort of my experience with my son, who, you know, I love dearly. And he's just like, just incredible. And he has this challenge that we did not see coming or couldn't have ever expected. And it is very hard. Yes. And so that's always just been interesting to me. Like I really always interested in talking to parents about just that gap between sort of that expectation and the reality. Mm-hmm. And all of these things can exist at once, right? Like you can still be obsessed with your children and think they're the best things in the world. Like most of us do feel like that way. And think, wow, they are so different in so many ways than what I expected.
Right.
And it's not a bad thing. It's just life. That's just life. Right. And so I think I have always been sort of interested in writing about these characters who end up being just so different, you know, than what their parents thought. I like writing about challenging children. I think that there's something so interesting to me about how powerful a child can be, you know, in an adult's life.
Yes.
In so many ways. And I've definitely written about children who can just really impact their parents at the, you know, snap of a finger. I think that's interesting. And I just think, yeah, I love the idea that we just don't know who they are. You know, we don't know who they're going to be in the world. We have so little control over who they are. It's just fascinating to me. I think it's like endlessly fascinating. The dynamic between parent and child.
I was talking to Angie Kim last week, and she said she had three children. Each when they were children, like a baby, had different challenges. She said, I couldn't get the same challenge three times. I had three different things happening. And she said, you're just there like, oh, wait, I was signed up for this. I'm not signed up for that. And it is, because you're just saying, oh, everything's going to be perfect. And, you know, it's going to be some commercial or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's life. It's just completely different.
We want it. We want easy. We all want easy children, you know, whatever that means. Everyone just wants an easy child. And there's no such thing. I mean, there's just not, right? And so, yeah, it's so interesting.
Yeah, it really is. You know, and I also love that at the book that it starts moving forward 9 months, not six, not three, nine. And I thought that nine is how long it takes to have a child. And in this case, Xavier's life is hanging in the balance. So is that like something like the 9 month thing that you were thinking there, or was it just the right season? It was the right season.
You know what? It's a little bit of both, but you're the first person to notice that you're the very first person to say that. And it is true. It's true. I was thinking the seasons did work, but I thought, oh, there's that 9 months is so symbolic. Yeah. So thank you for noticing that.
So now we talk a lot about the women in the book. Mm. And I feel like there needs to be a whole other conversation about the men. Mm-hmm. And the men, like, okay, Whitney's husband is away. Whitney's husband is doing his thing. It's not good for her. And all the women, the men are not what they want them to be. They all have different things that they want to have happening with them. And I think that was really interesting, because you could actually have a whole book club conversation about the men besides the women. And are the men supporting the women? Are they good to the women? And also, if the women are questioning the men and questioning what they're doing, what is really going on besides? So I just thought that the men were interesting, though they were all backstage characters. They would not have leading roles in the film. They would not have leading roles.
You're right.
Bit parts.
Thanks for mentioning that, because I feel like, and it's funny, a few people have sort of said, I wanted to like know more, go deeper on the men. And I feel like, well, it's not a book about them. You know, it is a book about the women. And they're all significant, you know, important characters. But I sort of liked that we were at a bit of an arm's reach, you know, from them, in a sense that we don't get their perspective. You know, we don't ever get their perspectives on things, and we really stick to the perspective of these four women. I think each marriage, you know, is a bit different. Each marriage has its own challenges, and each of these men kind of handles things very differently in terms of, you know, the way their marriage is going and the way they parent and the fathers they are. And I think, you know, what's interesting about Jacob, Jacob is Whitney's husband.
Yeah.
And in a way, Jacob is sort of a lot like Blair, you know, in a way. Like, Jacob sort of feels like maybe the marriage isn't what he thinks it is or wants it to be. He knows that Whitney is sort of, you know, probably has more going on in her life, in her world, in her mind than he is privy to. You know, there are some scenes towards the end where he sort of, you know, does probably turn a bit of a blind eye, you know, to some of Whitney's behaviors and the things she does and the way she is with their son. But in the same way that Blair needs to believe her life is going to be okay and everything's going to be fine and there's nothing wrong, you know, Jacob needs to believe that about his life too. You know, he needs to believe he is the one kind of really trying to hold the family together in the same way that Blair is. And so I thought that was just kind of interesting to be writing about, you know, a male character and a female character who, you know, are both sort of desperate for the same thing in their family life and in their relationship, and yet like coming at it from a very different, you know, gender role. And so there's some people who will think like, oh, Jacob is this weak character, you know, he's not a very strong husband, he's sort of this weak, plays second fiddle to Whitney, you know, and maybe that's true, or maybe it is that he is the strong one trying to hold things together, you know, while Whitney is making these other kinds of decisions. I enjoyed writing about Jacob. And then, you know, Aiden is Blair's other half, and Aiden is this very gregarious kind of, you know, the guy who, I think the dynamic between Blair and Aiden is that Aiden kind of reminds me of this guy, you know, who's like the loudest talker at the bar and sort of the, you know, he's telling a story and everybody's listening, and, you know, he always kind of he's getting all the attention all the time. And Blair is not somebody who she feels like nobody really looks at her in a room, you know, and we sort of see the beginning of their relationship, and Aiden sees Blair, you know, he sort of can't take his eyes off her And she feels like, who, me? You know, like, I'm the one you want. And so that becomes a very easy relationship for her, you know, and as someone who feels like she's never really the one anyone picks, he picks her. And so she suddenly, you know, under the arm of this bright light, and that does a lot for her. And that's kind of how their relationship starts. And it sort of starts that way and continues that way. You know, there's sort of that vibe to their marriage, you know, throughout. Yeah.
It's so interesting to just sit there and take a look at them as well. You know, I'm also thinking about the pacing in the book, because it's propulsive here. It's like boom, 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 boom. How do you ensure that you have that? I mean, I've heard that Lisa Garner said she puts cards down on the floor, and if it's not a yellow card, it didn't move enough. So she needs another yellow middle, and she's got the whole thing plotted out like that. Like, what do you do to make sure it's moving quick?
Oh, I love that. I love that. So I think, I mean, it's funny. I did at some point do something sort of similar, in a sense that I was struggling in one of the revisions, I was struggling with the pace. And I did do like a cut and paste kind of thing where I like printed it all out and like cut scenes up. And I did have like, okay, these scenes are quieter, these scenes are louder. And like, where's sort of the dull space. So I did something similar. It did not sound as nicely organized as that, but just sort of some visual, because I think when you get so close to the work, like you can't really see what is propulsive or what's not, you know? Right. But I mean, honestly, I feel like a lot, like, I feel like for most of the revisions that I did with my editors, and I did many, I feel like that was always a feedback, is like, you know, the beginning is like it's pacey at the beginning, and then it slows down, and then the opposite would happen, and then the middle is too slow, and then the end is like, you know, because it was changing so much. And I think with this book, in particular, like the timeline of the book is so important. Like there were so many timeline issues, because I was trying to kind of marry different timelines together, and the reveals were so key. And there was a lot of logistics of like people going to the hospital and people being on the street and who's where when. And so it was a bit of a mess to kind of like puzzle piece that together. But in the end, I think, honestly, I mean, for me, for everything, I revise a lot and revise heavily. And I think it's just in the revision and also getting fresh eyes on things, because I feel like even editors sometimes will think like they've read it so many times, like you need a fresh perspective to kind of come in and say, where is it slow? And where are you intrigued? And where are you falling asleep? You know,
right. Where do you want to pick it up more?
I shouldn't speak for other writers, but I cannot see that after a while. I just can't see, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I could definitely see that, you know, and it's interesting when you say the cutting and pacing, just picture, okay, I went to college pre-computer. So if I did a paper, and I was always the night bird. I mean, I was like 4 a.m. was like, whoa, that's like, you know, that wasn't my wake up. That was my hangout still. Yeah. And I would take and I have a cut, and there'd be across the room, and I'd be retyping it. And all these, like, you know, the tape, like reeling the whole thing in. And I'm like, oh my gosh, if I had a computer, I could have done so much more. I could have done so much faster. It's really, really crazy. Well, you start doing that and you're like, wait, where was that before? Like, where do I have to go find those words? And there was search and find.
No
there
search.
Was
none. That's right. Yeah.
No search and find. It was like the tape fell apart. That was your problem, you know? What I really like is the last chapter where the power really shifts and the power goes. And we're not going to say what happens, but was that always the ending? Because, oh, wow, that last line, it's great. It's Thank just you. Stop you.
Thank you. No, it was not always the ending. So I had some other endings. And I didn't, and the same thing happened with The Push, where I didn't come up with the ending until the very, like I had an ending and it wasn't perfect. And then I feel like in both cases, it was like right before the book was due that it kind of came to me. And then I'm sure that'll just always happen to me. But that was sort of a thing that, and I think the reason the endings come to me late is probably because it's just more time. You're just more time with the book, right? Like just more time with the book, more time with the characters. And you start to like wrap your head around what the book like is really about. And, you know, it just becomes so much more clear to you. And so I think the ending's easier to nail kind of later on. And I did have this, I think I am, you know, there's this whole thing, obviously people talk about like the first book versus the second book. And then, you know, after that, hopefully things get easier. But for the second book, I had in my head just the feedback about The Push had this kind of same similar ending, you know, where it was like a very impactful last line and that kind of changed everything. And I feel like people were expecting, like people wanted another like really good kicker at the end.
So
I felt a bit of pressure to come up with like a really good ending for this one. Like I couldn't just like get away with something that was sort of middle ground. So Yeah, I feel like I wanted to have a really great last line. Yeah, it was important to me, but thankfully it came right.
So nailed. So nailed. You know, like hit it. You know, I'm in a book, this a book group with a group of moms in the 40s, and we always talk about their push and the little pink mittens. I mean, we have so much fun talking about it, because I'll sit there and I'll say, I read The Whispers last time we got together. I go, oh, like the push. Whoa. Remember that book? That book kept me up at night. It kept me thinking like, whoa, what are my children like? Was writing The Whispers, okay, you said it was easier because, you know, it, you had done it before. You knew what you want to do. Was it easier than writing The Push? Was it?
No, I feel like they were both hard in different ways. Honestly, I feel like, I think there's a difference is, I don't know. Like, I think The Push is darker. The Push, I think I've had feedback that people feel the opposite sometimes, but I mean, it's arguable, but I do feel like The Push was sort of a darker territory than The Whispers. But I think like logistically, The Whispers was harder to write in a sense that you're on a deadline, like a much tighter deadline. And as you mentioned before, you know, I had done like a first draft before the pandemic, but all the work, you know, of revising, like all of that heavy lifting was all through the pandemic. And I just found that such a hard time. Like we all did, and we don't even need to, you know, we don't need to take ourselves back there and complain about it. And I am grateful and lucky that I'm talking about something I had to do at my kitchen table and not, you know, a frontline worker, of course. But I just like the creativity was hard. The time was hard. Like I had two little kids at home that were like trying to online learn, and it was just a bit of a, you know, a nightmare as it was for us all. And so I just found working through that, like just as a mom, no time and space. So that was probably trickier, but I also, in hindsight, like I think there were a lot of things about that time period that made their way into the book. And I think the book is a lot better for it in a way, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the closeness.
And I think it was a time when we were all like thinking so much about our street and our neighbors and the proximity we have to people. There is a lot of anger and rage in this book. And I think we were all feeling a lot of anger and rage, you know, on several different levels, you know, at that time. So I think in the end, the book was better for it, but logistically it was harder.
I always say that I said to my husband, you know, people say, oh, I wish my children were so little, said no one during the pandemic. I had no interest in learning multiplication, any kind of math or science again, but all the parents were like listening in, like, what are the children learning? And it's really, I think it must've been really hard for a teacher because you're doing online learning and the parents are like, right. Well, why did she teach it like that?
So I think that was so unfair. It was unfair for teachers. It was really, really hard and they were doing their best. And I mean, my kids were like in kindergarten. Like it was just nuts. It was nuts to be like trying to do school online. Yeah. But I was thinking the other day, because to your point, so I have a daughter right now that's in grade one. And so she just finished kindergarten. And we were talking at the end of last year with her teacher about like all of these sight words, like, you know, the sight words they have to learn that they can't quite like phonetically sound out. And she was sort of behind where my son was at that same time. And I was thinking like, wow, it's so interesting to me. Like, I wonder why she's like so much further behind than he was at that time. And then I thought back and I was like, oh, because he was at that stage during the pandemic. And I had like the whole wall of my kitchen had like sight words, like taped to the wall and all, you know, the addition, the basic addition of like, cause we were just like these kids, we have to teach them at home. Like we have to try, so I feel like I actually was so much more involved in what he was learning and trying to teach him because I was panicked that it was going to like ruin his education forever. Whereas my daughter, I was like, oh, the teachers got this. I'm fine. I don't need to worry about this. You know, so.
But this weekend you'll be wallpapering her room in sight words.
I don't have that energy. I don't have that left in me anymore, but yeah, it's pretty funny. It's also probably a first child, second child thing.
Right? My younger one, both of my boys learned to sight read. Like they just read words like I did. They didn't sound anything out. There was no, my younger one still says epitome. I was like, and it's a pint of milk. And I'm just there like, maybe at some point sounding out. And it's still, I mean, he's 28. He's got this great job. And everyone's will come out with like a word. And I'm just there like, explain that word. Like, I don't understand. But he totally gets it. He's like, do you use that word often? You know, it's really funny. So you came from a publishing background. You're a publicity director. So you know what it's like to get a book out in the world and all this kind of things. Did it influence you as a writer? Did it make you feel more pressure of, I know how the house is going to look at this. Like, oh, is she on time? Did everything come in? Is it
Yeah, I mean,
hard to deal with. You
know? I feel like it's really helpful in a sense that I sort of know you, once you sort of have an understanding of like how things work and how the marketing works and how the budgets work and all of that, it's sort of like, I feel like I probably ask less questions because I just kind of know, like, I just sort of know what, like how things go. But it's also, I think, sometimes I also think too, like, you know how things can go wrong too, you know, like you don't, like, I kind of feel like if you have no idea how really publishing works or you haven't kind of been sort of seen behind the curtain, I think sometimes like your expectations can be high or, you know, things like that. And I just feel like I have very managed expectations about how publishing works. Because you sort of see things that work. I've seen things that work and I've seen things that haven't, and you just never know. And you just can't take anything for granted. You just never know. Yeah. So I think it's helpful sort of in that sense. Yeah.
And I'm sort of, this is the kind of thing where we're recording this interview at the end of September. This book came out the beginning of June. How it took me so long to get to a book I loved.
Aww,
and
thank you.
We just said there's so much out right now.
So
that
much out. Yeah.
I've got the book. I'm dying to read the book. I love the first book. And you feel like, oh my gosh, am I playing like mean catch up here? But then you realize it's like readers do not always get to a book right when they hear about a book because something else comes up or whatever. And it was kind of a pleasure to find this and just say, oh, here's this gem I missed. Like, how did
great.
But I also am kicking myself, like, how did I do that? Like,
what it's so hard. There's so much else. There's so much out right now. I mean, I feel like that as a reader too. Like, I feel like I'm always reading for endorsements like that are coming, you know, books that are publishing next year or like 6 months out. And it's hard to keep up with those, because I'm so focused on those, I miss all the gems that come out too, you know, and I feel like I always buy the books. I want to have it, like the stuff that I haven't been asked to endorse, but I just love the author and I really want to read it. But I always have this growing pile of stuff that I think like, oh, I just wish I had all the time in the world to be reading. And I feel like it does feel like recently, I think especially this summer, there were so many great books that came out and it was just so hard to kind of get to them all. But you know, as an author, I think like it's obviously wonderful to have like this huge big thing out of the gate, but it's also wonderful to have a book that just has a steady march and finds a steady audience. Like that's great too. I think both things kind of work.
People are still looking for it. And I think that if people are looking to discuss a thriller and a domestic thriller in a book group, it's a great book because so many of the I'm not gonna say tropes, but so many of the themes in it are things that people are going to be able to wrap their arms around. I've got to get my group to do this. I think we really enjoy it.
Yeah, thank you.
When does your agent come in? Did she see it before your editors? Who sees what where? Or she sees first?
I mean, I know everyone's relationship with their agent is different in this sense, but I do love, my agent is Madeline Milburn. She's based in London. She's just wonderful. And I love for her to see it first. I like to do an edit with her first before I give it to my editors. Only because she sort of knows earlier on kind of what I'm hoping to do or what I'm trying to do or about the idea. And it just gives me, and she always has great feedback, or oftentimes she will say to me, a lot of her feedback sometimes will be kind of flags on things. Like she'll say, oh, I think your editors might want you to change that, but just wait and see, like, because she knows that she's not, you know, the editor on the book. But she'll give me the heads up about things or a heads up about feedback she thinks they might come back with, which I find really helpful because it's true. Like you don't really know how things are going to be received or what people are looking for. I also have three wonderful editors, which is like more than the norm. And so, and they combine their feedback and they work so wonderfully together and it's all such a great team. But there are like, because there's more voices in the mix, I think everyone's really great about saying like, you know, take it or leave it. I think that's so great. And Madeline's really, really good at that. And she also has some great people on her team that like are just great editors too. And so even if I'm like working on a scene or a chapter, you know, they're also available to kind of help and take a look and give feedback. It's wonderful. Yeah. It's really good. Really good.
I think it's the reason it comes off so polished because it's been looked at so much and gone through so much. So was The Whispers always the title?
It was. Yeah, it really, it was with this one. So I feel like while I was writing it, I had it, it was just untitled, like until I was kind of deeper into the revision. I was kind of midway through the revisions. And a friend had, I was thinking about what title to use. A friend had read it. And she knew I was thinking, trying to find a title. And she said, oh, what about like, cause I already had that scene in the book about the whispers and talked about the whispers and Blair was thinking about the whispers. And she sort of called that out and said, oh, what about this? Like this term, the whispers, like could really work. And it was a great suggestion. And so that became the title, and the editors loved it, and my agent loved it. And then the whispers kind of worked through, the idea of the whispers kind of worked their way through the book through a little more after that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the cover, mm-hmm. we've got this leaf, we're sitting there like hiding behind.
Yeah, I love the cover so much. I've been so lucky with both of my covers. That was designed by one of the cover designers in the US on Pam Dorman's team. And I just love it. I had been thinking about the color coral, like the push was very, you know, purple, like in all the markets, it kind of came out with this purple theme. And for some reason, I was just thinking about coral pink with this book, and they were too. And I like to think of those as like hydrangea leaves, which play, you know, a role. The hydrangea bush plays a role in the book.
It does. Yeah.
I'm so happy with it. I really love it. Yeah.
It's like really great. Really great. What about the audio? Do you have a hand in who does the audio? Because you have one narrator, right?
Yeah. And so with the audio, what happens is, so the UK have the rights to do, like, to produce the audio. So they kind of comes out of the UK. But I think the audio is so interesting. Like, and whenever I listen to audio, I only listen to nonfiction. I never listen to fiction on audio. Mm-hmm. And usually in nonfiction, it's usually like the person who wrote it, you know, who's reading it, which is such a neat experience. But for fiction, yeah. So what they've done both times is send me like a short list of people who they think are really great. And then I get to go listen to samples and kind of listen to other work they've done. And then we kind of make a decision together. But I've been lucky with both of them. Both of the narrators of my books have been so great. So it's fun. That audio part is really neat.
Go tell me a story. So for either book, I can't remember about the push. Is there any video or TV news? I mean, I know TV land right now is so super quiet. So quiet. Force majeure. I wonder what force majeure is in a big way, you know?
Oh yeah, I know. So yes, the push is currently being, so it was optioned to David Heyman, who's a wonderful producer. So their TV division is working on a limited series, which is really exciting. And there's some great stuff attached to it that's not announced yet. But hopefully not too long until we can kind of announce that and share that once things kind of get solved, hopefully, in that world, as you said. And then, they're kind of going through all of that right now for the whispers, which is really exciting. Yeah. Right. There's been some great stuff. So we'll see what happens.
One of the things that you think about is, there are not many sets that are needed to do the whispers.
Oh yeah.
And great point. Years ago, Mitch Kaplan, who runs Books and Books, also has a film company, Mazur Kaplan. And they came to my office and we were talking about books to be made into movies. And he's like, that's a lot of sets. That's a lot of period dressing. That's a lot of this. So think about here, you've got a neighborhood. That's really what you've got. So you get these houses. The houses, granted, you have to find a neighborhood that's got the right mix or something like that, or figure out how to do that. But it's there, like a lot of the story, until you move to the hospital. And it's just moving in and moving out. And I think that when people are thinking about books to screen, it's one of the things is, how many different sets do we need to create to do this? And Michael Connelly was at a panel that was on, actually I interviewed him for Hampton's Whodunit in East Hampton earlier this year. And we were talking about that beautiful house in Bosch, like up at the top of the hill, that great house, and how tough it is to shoot there.
It's
at the top of the hill. And how he was saying you had to pay off all the people on the street to not leave the house that day. You had to get all the equipment up to the house. Okay. Then if you're going to use the house in, let's say it's 10 episodes. Okay. If you're going to use it in 7 or 6, then you need those 7 or 6 directors to all be free on the 2 days that you're going to shoot the house. And when you think about that and you start doing the math of what needs to come in, what needs to come out, the changes of order, the change of this, to have this fantastic setting. And you see the same thing in The Lincoln Lawyer. He's got a beautiful home up there. And you're just like, Michael, houses on hills, you know, and what goes on. But we as viewers, like I find myself after hearing so much about books to screen, when I'm watching something of how hard it is to shoot this. And like recently I watched on Apple TV, it was on the plane. Oh, I'm so bad. I can't believe I'm not remembering the name of the show.
Terrible.
But it was all taking place on the plane.
Right.
Like so much took place on the plane. And I was just there like, I can't believe this. And
that's so interesting. I don't think a lot about that, but now I'm going to.
When you think about when you watch a show, just think Hijack was the movie. Hijack was the show.
Yeah.
And in Hijack, you're in the plane for most of the scenes. So you see like, where are you going to do this? Where are you going to do that? Very, very interesting, because I think people are watching and viewing more. Yes. And like, you know how to do that.
Fascinating.
So you're on something new. Where you're yeah. close on something new. You're
working on it, working away.
Yeah. So usually you're every 2 years. So you think maybe in two.
I hope so. I hope it can stay to like two and a half years. I hope so. Yeah.
Oh, so much fun.
The plan.
So much fun.
Thank you. Thanks.
And if so, I'll just book the date. I'll just write it.
Yes, we'll do it right away.
And I'm going to come back earlier in the process. I'm not going to wait till later. I'm like, 3 months. What are you doing? This is so good. You know?
Thank you, Carol. Thank you. I love chatting with you. You have such great questions and your insights on the books are just so good. And I could just, I could talk to you about this all day.
You just keep so writing them and I'll keep doing that. That sounds like perfect to me. And to our viewers, look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks to. Remember, all our videos are available on the Book Report Network on YouTube and Book Reporter Talks to wherever you listen to podcasts. And guys, we've got over 500,000, I think it's probably closer to 600,000 right now, downloads and views, which is really great. So we want you to be part of the next 100,000 that we do. So thanks everyone for joining us. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from The Whispers by Ashley Audrain, narrated by Jill Winternitz. Coming up after the credits, courtesy of Penguin Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. The show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from The Whispers, narrated by Jill Winternitz, courtesy of Penguin Audio. All rights reserved.
It's 5:30 in the morning on a Thursday in June. Blair Park sips her coffee and thinks about her husband spreading the thighs of another woman as wide as butterfly wings. She imagines him smelling her and then tasting her, his tongue circling, flicking. Blair's hand covers her mouth. She puts her cup down. She can't sleep. But she's been doing this in the morning now, indulging these obscene thoughts. Nothing feels good about starting her day like this, but it helps to satisfy her obsessive worrying so she can move on. Otherwise, she'll find herself consumed when she doesn't want to be, staring at the shelf of stain removers at the store, the ones in commercials that desexualize middle-aged, stay-at-home mothers like her, while she imagines a younger woman's mouth filled with her husband's semen. She pours a second cup that won't taste as good as the first and thinks about how hungry she is for something more. Although what, she can't name. The problem isn't just boredom or a wistful longing, not her sedate 10-year marriage and the ticking clock to complete irrelevance. Is this normal? Is this how other women her age feel? The idea of saying any of this aloud to anybody makes her diaphragm tighten more than usual. It's better to lift her chin and quietly face whatever hour is ahead of her, and the next hour after that, lest anyone suspect she's this miserable. It's beneficial for everyone, she knows, if the indifference takes over. If she soldiers on without the energy to care about what it is she really wants or how she really feels when her alarm goes off in the morning. Vulnerability, she knows, is something she should work on, something women are now supposed to exercise like a muscle. The books and the podcasts and motivational speakers have told them so. She tries to admire the ones who admit they've made choices they regret and resolve loudly to change. But that kind of upheaval is not for her. She cannot see any other life for herself, and she cannot separate the shame of having gotten it all so wrong. Another cup later, her daughter's bedroom door squeaks on its hinges upstairs. Her footsteps tap down the hard wood in the hallway, the toilet flushes in their only bathroom, and the plumbing hisses through the house. Blair wipes her hand across her tired face. Somewhere along the line, blaming Aiden for the way she felt about her life became convenient. He's been a reliable depository for her anger. She dumps and dumps and dumps, and he never seems to overflow. In her mind, there was little consequence to this. They are married, and separation isn't an option for Blair. The dismantling, the shape of everything changing, the perception, the impact on the daughter upstairs. She can't fathom it. The water runs from the bathroom tap. She hears Chloe pop open the mirrored cabinet where their three toothbrushes share a cup. She puts a bagel in the toaster for her daughter's breakfast. She's already taken the cream cheese out of the fridge so it's room temperature, the way Chloe likes it. Attributing her misery to an underperforming marriage had helped her cope well enough, until a week and a half ago, when she found a tiny piece of foil wrapper in the pocket of Aiden's jeans. Less than a square inch. Garbage to any other person who was to pick it up from the laundry room floor after turning the pants inside out for the wash. But she recognized the texture of the ribs in the packaging and the emerald jewel tone. It looked exactly like the condoms they used years ago. Every morning since she found it, she's opened the drawer where she keeps it and places it on her palm to wonder. There are countless other things it could be from. A granola bar, a mint from a business lunch. But more than any proof she has is a feeling.